You're listening to Panel Borders, Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and this episode continues our series of shows concerned with portrayals of masculinity in American comics. And in this show, I'm talking to award-winning comic book creators and graphic novelists Chris Ware and Daniel Close, who stopped in London during a mini-European tour. While I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Random House for setting up this interview at their HQ on Vauxhall Bridge Road, in hindsight, I shouldn't have placed my recorder quite so close to an open window above a busy thoroughfare, so you'll have to forgive the background noise. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
How is it that you're doing this tour together? Is it because you're firm friends and bounce off each other?
We're doing this thing in Copenhagen. Mm. It's not really a tour. There was a festival in Copenhagen, and once a year we try to get together somewhere. Okay. And we thought, well, we've never been there. Let's meet there. And then when these guys heard about it, they said, we've got to get you to open. And they actually didn't know. At the time we made that arrangement, I didn't know when my book was going to be out, and it turned out the right timing.
Good timing.
So, yeah. It's actually...
Yeah.
In a way, it's good timing, but I've just done a three-week tour in the U.S., and I don't think I would have planned it
immediately.
A trip right after if it hadn't been planned a year in advance.
How does travel affect you as creators? Because obviously you're very much associated with tales about Chicago, but at the same time, in, for example, Acme 19, there are flights of fantasy literally setting space. While in stories like Ice Haven, you've written stories that are very much about a place and about a place's history. Does geography particularly inspire you, or is it just a means to an end?
It's interesting because we were just talking about this this morning, how we've had all these trips to Europe, and you would think that we would want to do comics about authors visiting Europe or characters visiting Europe, and we were deciding that nothing would interest us less as readers, and that whenever we're reading, some writer that we like, whenever they have their little story about, like, their summer in Tuscany or whatever, we just, flip right past them. It seems to not have a... It seems to be a diversion from what the authors that I like are writing about, and to me, the only thing that would be interesting to write about travel would be to sort of cover the uncomfortableness of it, to do something about the sort of the alienation and the Kafka-ish elements of traveling, which are always present.
I think, in my own case, it gives me sort of fresh eyes at seeing things. It makes me see human beings as the sort of furtive animals that we really are, and see, like, it makes
rodents.
Buildings suddenly look really what they are, which is just containers for human life, and
hives.
I see people leaving buildings, and I think, do those people actually live there, and they're carrying sacks of food, and I think, are they really going to go home and eat that? It all seems like, and I realize, it's the modern problem of everything being a backdrop for one's own, personal performance or something, but it really helps you to see things without this sort of blurry skein of ideas that's always in front of your eyes, sort of making your eyes go in two different directions where you're not really paying attention to anything. Suddenly you're very, very focused again, and you're actually seeing the world, and it's kind of, time passes a little more slowly when you're traveling because you're actually paying attention to things.
Yeah.
I find myself deeply ashamed all the time I'm traveling at the Americanization of everything, to see them, it's like I take personal responsibility for the McDonald's and the Starbucks, and the fact that TGI Fridays has made it to the UK is just chilling to me. That seems like the lowliest business that would appeal to only like the most Midwestern type in America. Like, they would never have that in a big city in America. And yet, here it's been inflicted on the poor people of Britain.
And the terrible music everywhere, too. It's, even when before the plane takes off, you're hearing crappy pop music as if it's like the start of your movie, you know, your personal film. And then you land and the movie starts. It's like if your credits are rolling or something from your plane. Whatever, sorry. Complain about that.
Absolutely fine. Because you guys are here together, it's obviously made me think about the way that your two careers have intersected over time. For example, in the anthology that you edited, McSweeney's 13, there's a strip by Daniel in there. So when it came to curating this, for example, as a survey of American independent comics that were out there at the time, at the risk of talking to about the person who's right next to you, how do you see each other's work, sort of within the genre, or within the media, rather?
In the case of this, I everybody who I invited into that, I said you could rerun something, you could do something new. You didn't have, don't have to do anything at all. I just asked my favorite cartoonists to do stuff, and so it was up to each artist whether they wanted to do something new or include something old. As far as my own assessment of Dan's work goes, I mean, I think he's the best writer in comics that comics probably has ever had. His work is profoundly inspiring to me. I think about it all the time, and I think that probably is a fairly safe bet to say that applies to a lot of other cartoonists feel that way about his work too. So there's a leanness and a efficiency to his work that I see as a standard that we all kind of work towards, and it has this peculiar ability to set its roots in your mind and to grow in a way that you don't really necessarily expect, in a way that maybe Kubrick's films or Nabokov's novels have. Like, it has a life beyond just the experience of reading it, so, which is something I don't feel I have or my work has, and I don't know how to give my stuff that. But I think it's just a part of his genius as a writer and artist. So.
I mean, I've noticed this when you've been interviewed, Chris, that you do seem to be very humble about your own work. And in fact, you have attracted a lot of awards and a lot of great reviews, and I think very much justifiably so.
Well, that's nice of you. Well, you know, I mean, I see the holes in it probably better than most people do, and I know the flaws better than anybody, and I am very suspicious of any sort of, laudatory stuff, for lack of a more eloquent word. So I never feel comfortable with what I'm working on. Or if I do, it lasts, and I think, oh, I was crazy, and I was obviously not seeing things clearly. It's I don't know. I don't know if it's a mental problem I have, but it's just the way I've always been. I guess that's the way I'll always be. So.
I think it's very interesting that both of you have a certain formalism to your work, that the panel grid seems very much more carefully constructed than, say, in a lot of other mainstream comics, and the way that you both actually work in anthologies that tell longer stories in installments that then can be combined as graphic novels is the sort of the artifice of comics, but also the playfulness of comics, something that interests you both.
Well, I mean, I have actually stopped serializing my work, so I've decided to attach myself like a barnacle to the sinking ship of publishing, book publishing. I spent years embracing the form of comic books. I loved that it was this disrespected thing that people used to at least buy and throw away, or read once and leave on the toilet after they were done, but that format changed, and it got so that that comics were now costing $4, $5, $7, and they it got so that it didn't have that throwaway quality anymore. There was even though that quality hadn't really existed since probably the 70s, nobody's thrown away a comic book since that time. God knows there are boxes of them in every comic store in the world. But
I've thrown out a few.
Yeah, I have too. But and at a certain point, that the sort of the the necessity of working in that format disappeared, and I felt it felt more like an affectation than anything else. It felt like I was trying to make a comment by using this old antiquated format, you know, and the equivalent of a band releasing its music on you know, 8-track tape instead of whatever the hell they use nowadays. I don't even know what the latest thing is. Holograms. But you know, so I've sort of shifted over to focusing on complete books and doing them all at once, and it's kind of a whole new way of thinking about the comics for me. So it's you know, it's the latest thing. The kids love them.
But I suppose, I mean, with your work, Chris, having in an anthology such as Acme Novelty Library, different strips telling different stories in different styles next to each other, is that a way of keeping the work fresh for you, or bringing out different qualities by juxtaposing it with other strips?
Well, more it's just to keep doing it and to have a place to publish it periodically. I guess I'm still doing a periodical just because that's what I was doing before, and it's like I'm working on two very, very long books. I could wait maybe a few more years and publish them individually when they were completely done, but if I want to, first of all, keep having something in print and also maybe be able to survive doing them as a periodical is a little bit more comfortable for me, I guess, in a way. And so, I've tried to actually make the periodical as much like a book as I can, so I've made it into a hardcover over the past few years to try to dignify it a little bit more. I guess I could be maybe partly blamed for the dissolution of the periodical magazine format in comics, maybe a little bit when it comes to serious comics.
Okay, so we can blame you for bringing American culture to Britain, and you destroying comics.
I brought TGI Friday, and you just destroyed the comic book.
All very carefully.
Well done.
That's nice.
Because I think it's interesting that something like Acme 19 works as a book in its own right, and as part of a longer narrative that can then be collected at a later date.
That's the idea. I mean, I guess it's foolish. I mean, it essentially is a book, but I'm issuing it as a periodical.
In a way, it's crazy.
It is kind of crazy. I guess I should just be publishing it as its own book. So if I did, I would have 8 books done by the time I get done with this book. As it is, I'll have 1 thick book done, and, you know, 8 periodicals. So, but at least that's the way I'm working it.
I find I have a whole generation of readers who have no comprehension of the whole idea that I did comics and that the books are taken from the comics. You know, they just think of Ghost World and David Boring and all those comics as having existed as books, and that's how they saw them. And when you explain to them, it used to be this little pamphlet that came out, you know, every 6 months, and the stories would be in there, and it was serialized. You know, their eyes glaze over, and they have no. It's so complicated that I felt like, why burden the public with this kind of arcane knowledge? It's so much easier to just, here's a book, you know, this is, you don't have to, because people sort of feel like they're missing something if they buy the book and then they find out it was printed in this other form and I might have changed a few word balloons, and they feel like they're sort of, they're getting the you know, the Hollywood version that's been doctored in some way. So it's better to just keep it simple.
I think for a while, too, like publishers wanted to keep our periodicals in print, and in this case, I'm just doing a limited print run. This is the only appearance of that particular version that there will be. That's it's not going to be reprinted until the final book is assembled, so for better, of course. So.
The process of reformatting, though, I mean, I think it's interesting that, for example, Icehaven started off as a single issue of 8-Ball, and yet there was enough material in a single floppy, for want of a better word, that can be converted into a hardback format. Were you thinking in terms of both versions and publication when you first created the story?
Yeah, because I wouldn't have drawn it with such a sort of a specific page divide that could then be turned into a book. But I did that, and the next issue of 8-Ball, which was a comic called The Death Ray, I did them both with these full stories in mind, and I wanted each issue to have a complete story, and it just shows how stuck I was on that comic book format that I chose to to do them once as a you know, a saddle stitched pamphlet, and then knowing full well I would do them again as a book, it's really kind of a crazy way to work, and it just shows how deeply attached I was to that form, and I needed them to be in both versions in a way.
I always hated the comic book form. I just hated the size of it, the shape of it. I loved it. There's like something about it that drove me crazy, so I tried to do it in all sorts of different sizes that suited the content of the comics better. I mean, for better or for worse, we kind of came out of that when Dan started, when I started later on publishing with the company Fantagraphics. I mean, that was all they printed, with the exception of a few collections. So that was how you got your stuff published, you know, and it was cheap for them to print it and relatively cheap for them to distribute it in their limited, weird, adjusted way to comic book shops, so, which I guess still exists in a way. I guess I kind of acknowledge that by continuing to do a periodical that ends up mostly in comic book stores, I guess. I mean, I feel a certain kind of, I don't know if it's like loyalty or allegiance to that, but there's something about that I still sort of like a little bit. So.
I remember wanting to adjust the format of the comic, you know, add a half inch here or there, or do something like that, and they were so adamant that you could not do that, you know. It was all to do with the pricing of it, you know, and they had it figured out that if you added that, you know, anything to it or changed anything at all, it would add a little bit of money, and they just, you know, the comics were priced so low that they couldn't do anything like that. And then when Chris came along, all of a sudden he started doing these huge comics and tiny comics. I was like, wait a minute, how is he getting away with that? And then miraculously they sold, and I think that's when everybody decided, oh, it doesn't have to be this, because I can remember people in comic stores saying, like, we won't shelve anything that's not exactly that comic size, that's how our shelves are built. And Chris proved that was insane, and so he opened the floodgates, and now publishers are just so happy to do whatever you want. You know, you could have a laser etched glass cover in there, yeah, sure, you know, the more outlandish thing you can think of, the happier they are to do it, because it attracts attention.
Well, that must be quite fun in a way, just changing the format as much as you could, just because it suited the material.
Yeah, and it wasn't random either, and I have to credit Kim Thompson.
You do have to give Kim credit, because he had to, I'm sure that was a difficult decision when you first said you want to do it.
He was trying to figure out a way to make the second issue folded in half so that it would actually suit it. He finally wrote me a letter and said, I'll just forget it, let's just make it big, and if they don't want to buy it, then we'll lose $622 or whatever the press bill wants for it. So. I mean, at that time, I think people forget how limited in format and in scope comics really were. They were kind of constrained and constipated by this format. It just seemed to me, like, certainly based on the example of Raw Magazine and other underground cartoonists later experiments, that was sort of a silly, ridiculous.
Sure.
My ultimate goal in some way was to try to see if comics could get into bookstores a little more obviously. You know? Of course, that's hard when there aren't that many cartoonists doing things, as Art Spiegelman experienced when his book was published, and there were really no other comics being published. So, as Charles Burns pointed out a couple of days ago in Copenhagen, we were talking that the mainstream comics companies then just lickety-split collected a bunch of their older work and put it together in, you know, what looked like respectable editions. So,
yeah.
Aside from books like The Dark Knight and things like that. So. You really have to have a lot of authors doing work before something is considered a viable pursuit, right?
I mean, have either of you been pressured so far to adapt your comics to the digital medium so that they can be downloaded on an iPad or whatever? Or do you just want to leave that well alone?
I'm not opposed to the idea of it, but they have to get the technology so that people are reading it and it looks decent. You know, I don't trust that the technology will do that. You know, nobody realizes how terrible telephone technology is compared to what it was in like 1960. You know, you used to be able to pick up a phone and it sounded crystal clear, and you could hear the tiny, you know, details in the background. And nowadays, you barely hear. I can't remember the last time I had a telephone conversation where it wasn't cut off or, you know, fading in and out. And I feel like that's sort of the default mode of technology. People don't. Only a tiny segment of the public cares about the look of something being that clear, and so I just feel like it's going to be the colors aren't going to be correct, and feel like that's the very least that I want before I'll be excited about that as a format. And the size issue is a difficulty too, because you know, it's, if we've done comics that are supposed to be read this size and you're shrunk down to that size, it really doesn't work. And I don't want it zoomed in on the panel. You have to see the whole page. That's how they're drawn. You know, and at some point I may wind up drawing comics for that format if that's all there is. But you know, that's that hasn't happened yet.
Our orbital sugar reclamation capsules. I'm working on a strip right now for Wired that is specifically going to be reformatted for the iPad, and I've got ideas about using the touch sensitivity of it to try to contribute. But you're walking a really shaky line there of making essentially a glorified pop-up book, you know, that's like making a pop-up book of, you know, For Whom the Bell Tolls, you know, put a bell in there. So, I mean, it just is ridiculous, right. You know, so, but at the same time, I think one of the excitements of comics as a medium was the fact that they created this illusion of movement in a completely static form on paper.
Right.
And if you've got a medium that creates an illusion of movement through reading, and you're putting it in a form where you can touch a button and watch a movie, there's sort of like, well, why bother?
Yeah.
I could be totally wrong about this, because it seems like comics are just as popular as they ever were. People are fine with reading them on electronic media, and I just think, okay, fine. But I have a real affection for books, the corporeality of them, the fact that they kind of take bruises and bumps in the same way that people do. You take them on trips. They are filed away. They get lost. They get thrown away. Mm. And I would just be uncomfortable having my entire library on a hard drive that could go awry at any second.
I feel like we'll always be able to do books, though. You know, it's, you know, you can make your own book if you have to. You know, I feel like at the very least there would be some kind of nice limited edition book, and that would be the way I'd want the thing to be preserved. So,
if anything, I think it'll actually be good for comics, because it'll just help define them more as what they already are. I'm sure there's going to be e-comics or whatever they're going to be called, but the sort of stuff maybe we do if we stick to paper, and if there's still some printer somewhere that'll indulge us, or there's still some paper mill somewhere that's grinding up trees or recycling
out
paper.
Our own parchment from birch bark.
And when you've both worked in media that isn't comics, is that partially with an eye to perhaps send more readers to the print version? For example, you did animation for This American Life, and some of your comics have been adapted for film, which you actually wrote the screenplay for.
Right.
I mean,
I didn't do that with the intent of selling more books, but it sure helped. You know, it's sort of, I mean, I've just done a little tour of the U.S. for my new book, and it's kind of the first time I've gone out on the road in 6 or 7 years, and there are so many people who say they saw my movie Ghost World and then read the book and then started reading Chris's stuff, and you know, that's what introduced them to the whole world of our kind of comics. And so it's, you know, I guess I sort of suspected that might happen in the best case scenario, but I wasn't sure it would be that effective, and it's been it's worked better than I could imagine.
I mean I didn't think about it at all. I was just trying to make it emotionally potent presentation in the best way I could, if at all possible, in a medium that was sort of foreign to me. So, with the added bonus of being able to use music. it wasn't sort of like some nefarious plan to try to get the audience brainwashed into going out and buying comics or anything like that. Or
anything that's, you know, that's sort of sold as that kind of thing, like it's good promotion, it never is, you know.
On the other hand, McSweeney's, when I was asked to do that, that very much was done as a, because I knew it was going to go to a literate audience who maybe would or wouldn't be necessarily receptive to the idea of comics being thought of as a literary form. And at that time, it was still pretty shaky, I think. And I just wanted to make a beautiful book that dignified people whose work I liked and admired and had been inspired by and or stolen from, and present it in a way that hopefully a thoughtful reader would enjoy and maybe be made curious about. So I was really grateful to Dave Eggers for letting me do that. So.
Well, in terms of both your work intersecting with actual literature, as it were, you both did covers for a range of Penguin classics. You covered Candide, and Daniel, you covered Frankenstein. Was the entire range an effort to try and get people who wrote read comics to think, actually, there are books out there without speech bubbles in them? Or just an actually interesting way of combining the graphic design elements of comics into book design?
Well, without tooting my horn too much, actually, that started because an art director there named Helen Yentis asked me to do the cover of Candide. And she said maybe something along the lines of McSweeney's would be a start. So I asked for the whole canvas of the thing, and I decided what I wanted to do was do comic strips based around the story, because when I read the book as a kid, I kind of found it a hard slog, and I wanted to make something that would maybe draw in a younger reader into something that's admittedly a pretty funny book. I mean, there's horrible things that happen in the book. But when you're in 8th grade or 7th grade, when most kids are asked to read it, you're resistant to anything and everything. So, and then when that was printed, an editor there at Penguin saw that and said, wow, we could make a whole line of books based on this. And then they asked cartoonists then to... So now there's a whole line of books with comics.
Those are actually the default editions in America.
Really?
It's really interesting.
Cool.
You know, if you go to a bookstore and look for Lady Chatterley's Lover, there's Chester Brown artwork.
That's kind of strange.
It is strange.
On the irony, of course, that I pointed out is that Rudolf Topfer, who's more or less credited as the inventor of comics, was an educator, and he came up with comics as a way of kind of entertaining and diverting his students. You know, of course, students nowadays, or used to be, it was a cliche that you'd be in trouble for reading a comic book in class or for drawing comics or flip books in the corners of your book. So it's come full circle now.
And choosing Frankenstein, did they give you a long list, or when they first approached you, do you say, right, I want Frankenstein?
No, it was very funny. They had an idea of what I would want that was absolutely wrong. The first book they asked me to do was The Dharma Bums by Kerouac, and I was never really a fan of that, and I said, nah, I don't really want to do that. And they offered me a few others that were just not books I connected with, and they said, well, I guess we'll have to wait till later because the only thing we have left is Frankenstein, and I know you don't want to do that. I said, no, that's the one I want to do. I love that book, and I felt a great connection to that book, and it was funny. I actually I had heart surgery 3 or 4 years ago, and that was like the project I did right before I had, you know, my chest opened up. And so it's, you know, that's sort of the perfect book for that. You know, it's kind of all about that. And so I felt deeply connected to it.
That could have been the author's photo.
Yeah.
In that edition.
It was one of the few things I've ever read that I felt could be a great entire graphic novel. You know, it would be thousands of pages if you wanted to do the whole book, but it's just filled with hilarious, funny stuff. I mean, it's just the guy, Frankenstein himself, is such an awful guy, the Victor Frankenstein, and the poor monster. I feel such sympathy for him.
I think actually most classics are funny. I'm always
surprised
at the number
funny.
Of books that will make you laugh out loud when you're reading them, from Madame Bovary to even Marcel Proust. I mean, the whole could be misremembering of it. The whole cliche of the Madeline is actually echoed in the second book when he walks into like an outhouse and smells the filthy, musty wood. He's reminded of his aunt's couch where he like ravished a teenage girl, and then it comes back to remembering the aunt's Madeline's too. And I think, like, how come nobody ever talks about this? That's so much funnier and more interesting. And it's this extra layer of you know, the whole Madeline thing that you can buy in Whole Foods now to have your own little Proustian moment, which is such a false understanding of that.
In Frankenstein, when the monster comes to life, he's just sort of creeped out by him and leaves, and then he comes back and the monster's left, you know, clearly to go out and kill people. And he's just so relieved that he's not there. He's like, whew, that's, you know, I won't have to worry about that anymore. That's hilarious.
Wow.
Cool. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Oh, sure. Oh,
thank
that's
you.
It.
Well, I would love to talk longer, but there are 3 people apparently waiting for you.
Oh, really?
Okay. That's fine.
Well, thank you. Nice to meet you.
Ditto.
For more info about the graphic novels created by Daniel Close and Chris Ware, and to see a video podcast of my interview with them, please visit my blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. On next week's show, I'm talking to British artist Charlie Adlard about his work illustrating the popular American zombie series The Walking Dead, which has recently been turned into a TV series by the director of The Shawshank Redemption, and that's at the same time next week. Thanks for listening.